Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team Interview. Today is Tuesday, May 31st, 2006. The time is approximately 10 a.m. We are at the Lansing Delta Plant. And today we are talking, we'll first introduce the team.
Doug Rademacher.
And I'm Marilyn Coulter. Today we're interviewing John Cuthin. John, will you please state your name and spell it for us, please?
John Cuthin, C-O-U-T-H-E-N.
And your address, please?
2100 Ridgeline Drive, Lansing, Michigan.
Are you married?
Yes, I am.
And do you have children?
Yes, I do.
And they are boys?
Two boys, ages 23 and 21.
Now, where were you born?
I was born right here in Lansing.
Oh, and now what was your education level?
I am six classes shy of my bachelor's degree, finally. So it's within sight now. Been working on that since 2000, a little bit at a time. So looking forward to knocking that out here in the next 12 months.
Oh, so you've been very busy. Mm-hmm. Your plate is full. Now, were you in the military?
No, never spent any time in the military.
Right. And what did your parents do?
My father was a material handler at Oldsmobile here in Lansing. Eventually, he migrated to the Oldsmobile Transportation Group as an over-the-road semi-driver, bringing parts from the stamping plant to the body plant. My mother was a shipping clerk at the SBO plant here in Lansing.
So you've been real familiar with General Motors and the Lansing automotive history.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us what it was it like to grow up in Lansing? And were you familiar with Fisher Body, even though your parents worked at Olds?
Sure. It was a great growing up in Lansing. I mean, I couldn't imagine growing up anywhere else. Obviously, you kind of have some prejudice towards your hometown. But I thought, reflecting back, I think Lansing was a great place to grow up at. And you couldn't get away from the GM impact because everybody worked for GM. My parents, all of my uncles, just everybody either worked for or one of their spouses worked for GM. So it was.
What did you know about the Lansing Fisher Body Plant?
Well, the Fisher Body Plant just happens to be that my mother's oldest brother that lives here lives on Ottawa Street, three houses from the corner, which is where Fisher Body is at. So spending time at his house, as a little kid, you're right there by the plant. My earliest recollections of GM, though, go back to when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old. And we used to walk, my dad used to walk to work. We lived on Butler Street, which is now the actual driveway to the house that we lived in is the where you turn in to go to the parking lot for the historical museum.
Oh.
So from there, it was only about a 3-block walk down Butler to the main gate for Oldsmobile at the time. And so my mom, myself, and my younger sister would walk my dad to work in the afternoon. He worked afternoon shifts. And then we would go, there was a corner that we'd meet my two older sisters on. And then they would come back home from school. That was a daily routine. Walk dad to work and then walk my sisters back home from school.
So that was really neat. Having your uncle live right there on Ottawa. Is there anything that you remember seeing about the Fisher Body plant as a kid? And what did you think about that big green building?
It was noisy. More than anything else, you always heard just constant hammering, And several years later, in my adult years, actually when I hired in, I found out what the hammering was all about. Because right there on the corner of Verlinden and Michigan Avenue was the door department for both what was then the A line and the B line. And in the door department, you installed the doors, and to line those doors to get them to sit right in the door opening and properly set for door glass and things like that, you had to use a 5-pound machine hammer to drive the hinges forward or backwards to get the door to line up. And that's where all the hammering was coming from. But it was always noisy, but you really couldn't see anything on the inside except for, when the It got real dark at night. You could see the bodies passing by. So that's what I remember from being over at his house.
Doug Rademacher.
John, you said you grew up on Butler Street. Your uncle lived on Ottawa. Can you tell me, which high school did you attend?
I ended up going to Harry Hill High School, which is now the Hill Vocational Center here in Lansing. That was my family moved to the south side of town in 1970. I think I was 9 or 10 years old, born on 10 anyways.
Just knowing the demographics, I pictured you between the Olds and the Fisher plant on Butler Street. I thought you may have attended Sexton High School.
Sexton, but we moved. I was in fifth grade.
Okay.
And now, what did you do before you hired into Fisher Body?
Went to high school, basically. I hired in 3 months after graduation. You know, had the summer of fun and, you know, what kids typically do after they graduate. And I was between, you know, going to school and getting a job, and I really hadn't really applied myself that well in high school, so I didn't have great grades, but I could have gone to school, but the other thing that was keeping me back was money. So I opted to go to work. Initially, I only planned on working for about a year. That was my plan. I was going to work a year and then save up enough money and go to school, and I was going to be an accountant.
An accountant? Mm-hmm. So, when you hired in, what was the hiring process, and what did you think about it when you first walked in inside Fisher Body?
Well, the hiring process was you could either do one of two things. You could show up early in the morning and stand in a line that extended all the way down Verlinden past the elementary school and was probably four abreast, you know, just hundreds and hundreds of people, which was the situation when I arrived at about 10 minutes to 8 in the morning to put my application in. And rather than stand in that line, I decided I would go play golf instead. And I did, and I went and I played golf, stopped by one of my friend's house, kicked it with him, and basically just blew the whole day off. However, I committed to my father that this was a plan I was going to do. I was going to go get a job with General Motors, and he was going to make sure that I followed through on that. So I knew that I had to do something because he was going to ask me when I got back home. So at about 10 minutes to 4 in the afternoon, I decided I'd drive back by the plant again, and the line was gone. There was nobody in line, and initially I was going to just drive on. And I said, no, I'll stop. Let me just check. So I actually double parked right in front of the plant there in a no parking zone and went down the stairs to the front main entrance. And they were taking applications right there in the lobby. And the two people that were taking those applications were Jerry Brooks and Tina McClellan. Tina still works for GM. She's in salary personnel over at the Grand Rapids Metal Fan Plant. But Jerry Brooks actually took my application. I asked him if I was too late, and he said no. And my first thoughts were, you know, when I filled the application out, he turned around and time-stamped it. And so, you know, early bird gets the worm. That's what you're always taught. And so I was sure that I wasn't going to get a job because I came and applied so late. But at least I had myself covered with my dad, you know, and I could go back home and tell him, yes, I made an application that day. So that was day one. The next day, Oldsmobile was hiring also. And so I went over there and filled out an application. They didn't have nearly the line that Fisher Body had had. And this was actually the second day of their application process, too. And so I filled out an application at Oldsmobile. I can't remember exactly what day of the week it was, but that was early in the week, like a Monday or a Tuesday. I think the Monday was the Fisher Body day that I filled out an application, and Tuesday was Oldsmobile. And I think it was Thursday or Friday. It was Thursday. I got a call from Fisher Body, and I got a post, little 5x7 postcard from Oldsmobile on the same day. And I believe it was Thursday because it seems like I had to report the next day for an interview and physical, and I had to choose between Oldsmobile and Fisher Body. I had two job offers in my hand. And I chose Fisher Body. And I couldn't tell you why, other than the size and complexity probably of the Oldsmobile site was just a little overwhelming. And, you know, all you ever saw of Fisher Body really was the front on Verlinden, and it didn't seem quite so intimidating. So I don't know that's the exact reason why I chose that one, but that's where I went. And so I reported when they asked me to. They interviewed me. I was still somewhat less than optimistic that they were going to hire me because everyone had told me he had to be 18, and I was only 17 at the time. But I had graduated from high school, and that's all. I let Tina McClellan actually did my hire interview, and I let her finish the whole interview, and then I asked her, because I figured that was my one saving grace that would get me out of it, was that I was only 17. So I asked her that, and she said, no, you graduated from high school? And I said, sure. And I had a copy of my diploma in my wallet, and that was all there was to it. And from there, they sent me down the hall for a physical, and it was Monday. After the weekend, I had to go to an orientation, and then I think I started a day or two after that.
Really, they had orientation.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first department?
My first department, absolutely.
And that was what?
That was a townhouse over, you mean apartment or department?
Department that you
worked
in.
Oh, I thought you were getting off into my shenanigans. My first
that comes after, after your first paycheck.
Yeah, I remember very, very well. It was actually 4 months after my first paycheck. But, I worked in the door department.
In the body shop.
In the body shop. And I remember when they... they had all the new hires sitting where the general foreman's offices were. And at that time, the general foreman's offices were near the front, actually by the old labor relations office, is where all the general foremans all had an office back there. That area later became quality, I think, just as the plant was getting ready to close.
Excuse me, John, but for people who won't understand what that is, can you please say what a general foreman is?
General foreman was he'd have six or seven foremen on a shift in the department reporting to him.
Okay. Thank you.
So that's where they pick you up at, was back there. And they walk you out, and they initially walked me out to what was the underbody area, or the jungle, as we used to call it. Because the reason they call it a jungle was because all the spot well guns were hanging from, high up. And so you couldn't see anywhere. It just looked like a real thick jungle of vines and things like that. And it was just actually cables and wires holding spot well guns. And actually, that was a little intimidating walking through there. And eventually, they worked there. They were dropping people off, to different supervisors as they made their way through. And you're half scared, half... overwhelmed, just interested, curious, looking at things, trying to make sure you don't trip and fall or get hurt. The first time you see a spot well gun go off and the sparks fly right at you, that's a little unsettling too. But finally made my way with the general foreman to the foreman that he was going to assign me to over in the door department, and that was Jim Sims. And if anybody knows Jim Sims, he's quite a character. Mm-hmm. That was my first boss, Jim Sims. And went to work. Lunchtime came, and I tried to go to the cafeteria. I got lost on my way to the cafeteria, and I got lost on my way back.
So. Was the distance from the parking lot to your job and from your job to the cafeteria a long
distance?
Well,
actually, the parking lot wasn't such an issue because it got dropped off. Okay. However, when they gave us the instructions of where to report to in the orientation, they assumed that everyone was going to park in the parking lot because you were driving. Well, I didn't have a car, so my mother actually had to drop me off. And so where she dropped me off at, though, was in the front of the plant. the instructions were from the back of the plant. So I didn't know what to do, because if I went in the front, I was going to be lost, because I didn't have directions from the front of how to get there. And actually, you were right there. So I walked all the way around the plant and came in the back and proceeded to get lost anyways, because at that time the paint shop was down on the first floor, and that's what you had to walk through the paint shop to get back to the front of the building. So that's how my first day started.
So your first day, knowing that initially you really were trying to get out of working there, what was going through your mind on your decision to come in here? Like, how'd you feel?
I was scared. I think you know no one's really totally prepared for, you know, that work pace, that work environment. You know, everybody that you're working with is old enough really to be your parent. They're, you know, in their 40s, 30s, you know. To me, 17, a 30-year-old is ancient, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and every now and then there's a person in your same age group that you recognize, you know. So that was, but it was not easy. And it was no guarantee that I was going to make it, you know, because I just struggled with the job that they put me on. I was a door hanger, and a very demanding job. At the time, you know, I think I weighed about 175 pounds. The doors that we were lifting were in excess of 60 pounds. They were the big Tornado. The last year that we built the Tornado, mm-hmm, was 1978, and we were building the 78-mile Tornado. And I was hanging the doors on the passenger side.
Now, did you have any type of assist, or were you just manually putting
those
doors on?
Well, you had an assist, but that was, you had a fixture that you put the door on into the fixture, but your door actually came on a monorail. Okay, they didn't come in racks, they were on monorails. And the monorail was quite a ways away from the line. So you had to go get the door off the monorail and then carry it back to the car. That was the toughest part of the job. And they had a hoist, but, you know, it took a little finesse to learn how to use that. And I never did learn how to use the hoist. Nobody used it because it was cumbersome and it was tricky to work. And you couldn't make any mistakes with it, or the car would be gone by the time you got back with the door.
John, when you hired in, were you on the first shift or the second shift?
First shift, which compounded things, but actually turned out to work in my favor, because from on the first shift, I was obviously the lowest seniority person there. And that was a very difficult job. Back then, when they did a shift preference, the high seniority person who was on the second shift, they had to take out the lowest senior person on the day shift. And the lowest senior person then went to the opening, or went to where the bump originated at. So I had a very high senior person decide that they wanted to go to days, and that's who bumped me. Consequently, I went from the worst job in the body shop to the best job in the body shop. So while I was going through all this fretting, you know, for the first 3 weeks to a month, once I landed on the night shift, it was a whole different world.
So when you went from the day shift to the night shift, what job were you doing on the night shift?
I had a door striker job, which was just putting in the striker that the door latches onto when you close, mm-hmm, it. And then you had a power wrench and you put that in. It screwed right in. And then you close the door and look at how the door alignment was. And then you just had to adjust that little screw up and down, left or right, to make it right.
Okay. You said that you started out on the day shift working with people who were old enough to be your parent.
Mm-hmm.
Then you went to night shift. What was the climate like, or because you're working so hard, did you even realize what the climate was like that you were working with in the day shift?
On the day shift, it was, like I said, it was very cliquish. You right away, I mean, you didn't fit with anybody. So it was kind of lonely. Because other than your friends that had gotten hired in and that were working in other areas, you didn't dare venture off, you know, go exploring or anything. I had that experience my first day, and I stayed right in my work area, you know, once I found my way in. But it was, you felt kind of alone. I had a very nice relief man. I can't remember his. I know his first name was Keith. I can't remember his last name, but he was very nice, and he always took extra time to help me learn little tricks to do the job. And you know, he'd see me sitting by myself during breaks or whatnot, and he'd come over and talk to me.
So he kind of took you under his wing.
Yeah, he had a son who had played football against me in high school, and so he recognized my name, and that's just kind of how we got to be friends.
Being a new hire, being young, and being isolated a little bit, did they ever play any pranks or jokes on you as a new hire?
No, They never did. They were. They actually, and they gave me a nickname. They called me, it was kind of one of those, you're the opposite of what they call you. And my nickname was Lightning because they were, you know, I was slow. It took a long time. You had to drive six, you know, once you got the door situated in the fixture, locked down, ready to go, then you had to put six screws in it. Then you had to unhook the fixture, push it all the way back, and then grab your hammer and start banging on those hinges. Took a long time, so obviously when you're young, you know, you try to do a good job, but you only got so much space to work with, and so it was just taking me a little bit longer, and they nicknamed me Lightning.
Lightning.
Yeah, so. But other than, I mean, that was fine, but everybody was very helpful. I mean, even the person that you thought was just as grumpy as could be, they wouldn't let you fail. I mean, they would jump in, and they'd help you. You know, do whatever repair or fix whatever, you know, you didn't get done.
Okay.
Doug Rademacher. John, you're 175 pounds, just out of high school, 17. You're a strapping young lad. Played football.
Mm-hmm.
You said these doors weighed upwards of 60-plus pounds. And the nickname Lightning, you said it was... right off the bat, you still weren't sure if you were going to make it.
Yeah.
And yet you saw all these people around you. Can you just give someone that's never seen the auto industry or assembly line, how often did a vehicle come at you that you had to throw 60 pounds, finesse, and put the bolts and swing a hammer? How much time did you have?
Can you describe that? Well, time was really... It wasn't so much the car, because the Tornados were on what was the B-line, which had Olds 88s, Olds 98s, and Tornados on it. And the Tornado mix on that line was every third car was a Tornado. So you had a three-car working envelope, but you had two other people working with you, and then you got every third car. Well, the high seniority guys got the 98s, the low seniority guy got the 88s, I mean the middle seniority guy got the 88s, and the new guy got the Tornados because the Tornado door was bigger. The Oldsmobile coupe doors, sedan doors, so they were, you know, it's a four-door, so it's a smaller door. Same way with the 88, they're small doors. The Tornado was a coupe, bigger door, new hire. You get the hard job. It's always been that way.
So in... the line speed is what I guess I'm after.
Oh.
How often did these cars go by?
You were building better than 1 minute. So if the line speed was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 65 to 68 jobs an hour.
And so you were actually throwing a 60-pound door less than every 3 minutes
less
and
than
having
every
3 minutes, to...
about every 2 minutes and 40 seconds, 2 minutes, 50 seconds.
Did you, people around you, you said they never let you fail... even though they were quite a bit older than you, how long did you work with them before you went to the night shift?
About 3 weeks, three to 4 weeks.
In that short amount of time, did you learn an appreciation or a respect?
I think the respect took like one day because it was very sobering. And I didn't have any expectations that it was going to be easy when I went in there. But it was hard work. And I had worked as a student, as a high school student, I'd worked for the Department of Social Services in their warehouse. So lifting boxes and things like that and shipping stuff, that was what I did. And some of those boxes would be heavy, and it was hot in there, so it was hard work. It wasn't easy. But that was nothing like building a car in an assembly line. That was hard. And every night that I left to go home, I wasn't 100% sure in my mind that I'd be back the next day. Because it was just, all I could think of was just trying to make it home. And then the next morning, you wake up, and you'd have to do it over again. And it was a struggle just to drag yourself back in there. And many, many days, I wasn't even sure I was going to be able to tie my shoes because my hands hurt so bad, you know, and were so stiff. But once you got up and you got going, and once that horn, back then there was a horn that sounded in the body shop when they were getting ready to start the line. When the horn sounded, you just took off and you did the best you could. And, you know, 15, 20 minutes into the day, everything would kind of loosen up, you know, and your fingers would start working again and whatnot. So that was pretty much it.
The only thing else, early there, first day, second day, standing in line with these older gentlemen to punch in and out.
Yeah.
Did your thought drift to your father?
No.
Never thought about him going to work
every
day?
This is what I thought about him, because my mother dropped me off the first day. After that, I rode with my dad. And every time I thought I wanted to quit, I had to think about who I was going to have to tell that I was quitting. And he was number one on the list because I rode to work with him. And, you know, I'd lay down at night and I'd tell myself, okay, tomorrow you're not going in there because you can't do that. So you might as well just tell him when he comes to wake you up tomorrow morning, tell him you quit. And so I said, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell him I quit when I wake up tomorrow morning. Well, that never did quite build up the nerve or the guts or whatever to confront him and tell him that I was going to quit. So that's what really saved me, you know, in my career with General Motors was my father and the fact that that was a confrontation that I was not willing to have.
There was a standard or a work ethic in that house, and you knew what was. It was tough, but you knew if he was doing it, and then it was expected of you.
Yeah.
Now you made it the 3 weeks. You went to the night shift.
Yep.
And you said, can you describe the part you put on at that point from a 60-pound door? What's the striker?
Door striker is it looks like a long bolt with washers on the end of it, and the washers serve as like a shim for spacing, and probably 3 inches long. Probably weighed less than, you know, maybe 8 ounces or so.
A half a pound.
Yeah.
Now, did your wage decrease when you had an easier job?
No.
Did you ever wonder about the disparity and the workload in those jobs?
Never thought about disparity. You know, as long as I had a good job, I was all set, and I figured I'd be here 30 years.
Well, initially you said you were going to go 1 year.
Yep.
And go to school.
Yep.
Can you tell me about that 1 year anniversary?
Well, the first year, typically, I think by the time you get to the first year anniversary, you know, you've gotten addicted to the money. And I still knew that at some point I was going to go back to school. Just didn't know it was going to take me, you know, 22 years, 23 years to finally get off my butt and do it. But lifestyle changes. When you don't have anything and then you all of a sudden you do and you start spending it and you want more. You know, it's the American way. And that pretty much settled my fate. You know, by the time I had been working a year, I had a brand new car. I had an apartment or a townhouse. You know, all the toys and gadgets that a young single man would want, you know. And I didn't have a lot of money in the bank, but I had everything I wanted. And come every Friday night or Thursday night, you know, I had a pocket full of money. So I couldn't see myself walking away from that.
Marilyn Coulter, John, You initially started on day shift, and then you went to the night shift. And being 17 or 18 by now, maybe?
Nope, not quite.
Till 17?
I didn't turn 17 for the... It was 2 months after I hired him.
What was the differences that you noticed as far as people in the environment between day shift and night?
Younger people, much younger people, and... the difference was day shift was quiet. All you heard was the tools. Night shift, it was music. Not too loud, because all you had back then was transistor radios. We didn't have boom boxes or anything. But they did allow, you know, you to have a radio if you wanted to listen, and people were listening to the radio. And it was just a much more relaxed environment.
Was it relaxed? Did they have as much supervision on the nights? Yeah, was it more relaxed because there were more young people on nights?
Just because there were more young people on nights. I felt more comfortable on nights. You know, maybe it was all perception and all paranoia on my part, but I was more comfortable.
Yeah. Finding that comfort zone in the plant, were you able to develop long-standing relationships with those people in the plant? Did you work did you even work in the body shop?
Yeah, I always worked in the body shop for the entire time that I worked in production. I made some friends. In terms of lasting relationships, a lot of the people that I worked with, I still work with. Some of them have gone to different jobs, and some of them are now union representatives. Mm-hmm. I'd say I made some friends there.
And they extended outside the plant?
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that your work family became part of a family for you?
I don't know that I'd say that. I wouldn't go that far. It wasn't that close, you know, back then. Mm-hmm. Because you still had your job and only your job. And, you know, I knew my repair guy, you know, who was a couple feet down from me. My job was the last one before the department repair station. Mm-hmm. So I knew the repair guy real good. He and I talked a lot. And he just happened to be going through a divorce and needed a good psychiatrist at the time, and I think I filled that role for him. But he and I got pretty close.
John, working in the body shop, how long did you work? I know you've had quite an interesting career that we're going to get into here shortly. How long did you work in the body shop?
I worked in the body shop from 1977 until 1980, 80, 81-ish.
What happened for you in 80, 81?
Well, I had actually gone back to LCC, and I had just finished an advanced statistics class. And the plant was starting to roll out statistical process control. And there was a two-day workshop that they put everybody through in the body shop, or at least that was the initial goal. And when I went through the SPC class, I believe the person who was doing the facilitation of that class recognized that I knew a little bit about statistics. As it turned out, they were looking for someone to partner up. This is one of the first joint things that we did, starting in 1980, and they were looking for someone to partner up with the management person. They wanted someone from the UAW to help teach these classes, and they selected me. And the selection process was nothing like it is now. I mean, it was just, you know, the person who I was going to work for wanted me to do it, and they went to the union chairman, and he said, yeah, go ahead. That was it. And so that's what I did from 1980 until midway through 1981.
So prior to that, were you involved with the UAW at all?
Never had made a committee call, never... Didn't know what a grievance was, didn't know what 78 was. I had never...
Just paid your dues.
Never done anything, really.
And then you became a statistical process control instructor.
Facilitator for, like I said, about a year and a half.
Okay. Once you became a facilitator, did you get active with the union at all, or were you primarily doing your job?
Just doing my job.
Okay. How long did you do... the stats. And then, well, before I go there, How did the management personnel like having an hourly person helping them teach?
I can honestly say that they treated me the same as everybody else.
So there was a true partnership then?
Yeah, there was actually four of us that were doing it. It was good. But, you know, the roles were limited, too. You had what you were supposed to do, and the management person had what they were supposed to do. Mm-hmm. You know, it was pretty cut and dry.
Did you have much of a say in the outline
No.
that you did? You just did your job. Mm-hmm. How long, and how did your coworkers like having you do a job like that?
My coworkers, as in
the people that I used to work with on the floor?
Exactly. Well, when I left from the floor, I didn't really know, you know, that was going to turn into a permanent job. It was really like a 30-day, you know, assignment that just kept getting extended, and then it was 6 months, and then it was, you know, another 30 days, and so it just kept going on and on. So my expectation was that I was going back to that job. I never made it, because right at the end of the SPC stuff, and actually while we're halfway through it, 1981, QWL started to get rolled out.
And what is that, please?
Quality of Work Life, that process. And so I went from SPC directly into doing QWL as a union person.
And what was your responsibilities with the Quality of Work Life?
Facilitating the workshops and introducing people to the concept of improving quality of work life in employee participation groups. Mm-hmm. That was a 40-hour workshop. So it was that was a 2-day workshop as well. 40-hour stuff was offsite.
So General Motors had you trained to do that, and then you began to roll that process out.
Right.
So it went far beyond doing just statistical processes.
Yes. Yeah, just went from one to the other.
And then and how long did you do that?
Oh, as an hourly person, I think I did it for a year and a half.
For a year and a half.
From 81 until early 83. And in 83, there was a job that came open in the quality, what was called quality control then, as a statistician analyst. And it was a salaried position. And I interviewed for that, and they offered me the job, and I took it. And a pay cut, by the way.
So you were an hourly person in one department, and you were training, mm-hmm. and then you went to management when you interviewed for this next job.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a difficult process, being an hourly employee?
I don't understand the question.
Well, was it a difficult process? Was it an easy job for you to segue into?
Yes.
Because you had already worked in the process
well,
with some of the
managers. What made it easy was I didn't, as an analyst, you know, it's a fifth-level job, so you're not supervising anybody. Mm-hmm. And it was really kind of seamless for me, because all I was doing, they had a function back then that was called critical audit. And basically what it tracked was the number of defects per car. And that was my responsibility, was to track that, keep that data, and then to share that or present that data on a weekly basis to the plant staff and their morning staff meeting.
Doug Rademacher. John, before we move on into this, move into the management side of the business, you said that you were recognized for your abilities and that they wanted someone from the UAW side to work with the corporate side, and you were referred by your supervisor? Or somebody had recognized you?
No, somebody recognized the guy that I actually ended up working with when he taught the class, recognized that I had some abilities.
And I was just curious, was there ever a time where your UAW, since it was a position they wanted to more or less marriage together in a working relationship, was there a president or a shop chairman, someone that had to approve this move, or was it only management's decision?
No, it was the union's decision.
And do you remember who that was?
Yeah, it was Don Brown.
Don Brown.
John, when we talk about work environments and work groups and being a quality of work representative and a statistician, you went into a different type of element as far as that. What was that like insofar as having coworkers and things like that? How did they treat you?
Fine. Just another group of folks, but overall treatment was no different than when I was hourly.
When you were a quality of work life representative and taking that new project, and actually that's one of the beginning of the new processes that the workers were going to be taking on, was that something that you think actually did help the quality of the work inside there as far as getting hourly representation active in the business?
It was a start. I mean, it took many, many years, and I think we're still evolving to that, but that's where we started changing the workplace. And then I think a lot of the things that we do today are a direct result of what we did in 83. So I'm really proud of being part of that because it wasn't easy. Mm-hmm. There was skepticism doesn't even begin to, comprehend what it was like, trying to pitch this idea of a more democratic workplace.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of down the road a little bit, but however, since you were a worker and you talked about the work life, one of the things they talked about Lansing was we were always called the capital of equality. Do you think one of those things had anything to do with programs such as that?
No, because the quality of work life was a corporate-wide initiative. We weren't really the trailblazers on that. There were a lot of plants that were doing things a couple of years before us.
What do you think made Fisher Body special as far as the workforce?
Oh, boy. I don't know quite how to describe that. And I'm not so sure that at that time I really recognized that it was unique because it was, it only seems unique if you've got something to compare it against, and I didn't. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like it was just normal. Mm-hmm. Like that's the way it should be.
That's the way we do things. Doug Rademacher.
John, as we talk about that, the capital of quality, the Lansing being recognized for its quality of achievements, what about you said earlier on about the old guys, they wouldn't let you fail? That's something that's connected to that capital of quality.
I think there was, or always has been, some a high level of pride that people have taken in their work in this workforce. And if one person wasn't functioning correctly, I think they took that as a reflection of the whole group. And that was, we weren't a formal team, obviously, but we were a team. You had six door hangers. And, we worked together. I wasn't able ever to get to the level where, at that time, when I first hired in, to where I was able to help anybody else, but I know that eventually I would have gotten there, and then the next time a new person came in, it would have been expected, that you helped the new people out, because it was a difficult job to learn. And in fact, just going back, I didn't stay on that door striker job forever, because eventually I tried to get back to Days again, which I did, and when I got back to Days again, I was put back on the door hanging job. So I actually went back to the door hanging by choice. But that was maybe 79. So I had been there about 2 years. I had an opportunity to bump out the lowest person. And there was a person on Days that had less time than me. So At some point, you know, your life changes, and it's more important to be on days than it is to have an easy job. I knew I was going back to a harder job, but it was more important for me to be on days.
Be on days.
Yeah, an easy job.
But when you went back to that door job, did you get the coupe doors again?
Actually, we had stopped building the Tornado, and they had actually built a new body shop out in Building 16, where the M body shop went to. When the plant got ready to shut down, that body shop that was on that side, that was all new back in 79.
John, you've spoken about M body shops and C body shops. Can you let people know a little bit what's the difference between the two and the, having the two different
it's
names?
It's a different system altogether. There's two systems that was kind of unique to Lansing Car Assembly. It was a dual system plant that had two assembly lines. And you had the A system, which ran the Cutlass models, and then the B system was the bigger cars, 88s, 98s, Tornados, which later became, from A and B, it went to M and C. So just a different change of letters. I don't know why, but they did.
And what was, there was something that was unique about the way Fisher Body did vehicles. You want to explain a little bit about that?
Just building the body, the shell, all the chassis and engine assembly took place across town at Oldsmobile. So the bodies were shipped by body haulers across. All we worked on was the shell on the body.
Doug Rademacher?
Just to clarify that, so the body was unfinished and it was shipped to another location to be finished?
Well, the body was finished. I mean, it was painted, had glass in it, interior was complete. What it didn't have was a frame, chassis, brakes, tires, engine, and front fenders and a hood.
Okay. John, would you say what made a good or a bad supervisor in your eyes?
Well, I've worked for both. A good supervisor was someone who was always approachable, had empathy for you as an employee and the work that you were doing, and if things weren't right, which quite often they were, was there to try and help you or get you the help that you needed. Bad supervisors, just the complete opposite. You know, were mainly attendance takers, and that's the extent that they wanted to get involved with you was, you know, I'm here to make sure you do your job, not I'm here to help you do your job.
Now, when you transitioned into a management position, do you feel coming from the assembly line it was an asset to you to know, to recognize a worker's needs or his difficulties?
Not early on, because like I said, I went to quality, and I didn't supervise anybody for maybe the first 2 years when I was on salary. It was probably many, many years before I really gained a full appreciation of it and had to reflect back to what it was like. I spent 6 months in 1995. I ran a department as a supervisor. Just for 6 months. And I knew going in I was only going to be there for 6 months. So that kind of puts you in a different frame of mind. But I also knew what it was like to work on the line. And you know, I tried to respond accordingly.
John, so you went from the status, from the quality department, and how long did you stay in quality? Until you went to the line?
No. I went from quality back to QWL as a salaried person. So I was an hourly QWL person, then I went to quality as, on salary, and then eventually back to QWL as a salaried QWL person.
And how long did you do the salaried QWL?
I did salaried QWL until 1990. So that would have been 7 years.
What happened for you in 1990?
In 1990, I was asked to interview for a job as a labor rep. in the early spring of 1990. I didn't know what a labor rep was, but the person who was asking, I thought highly of. And so because he asked, I sought it out, you know, and actually applied for it or self-nominated for it, and got an interview, and I didn't get the job. Someone else got the job who became one of my closest working buddies. But I did get told why I didn't get the job and was also committed to the next opening that occurred in that department was mine if I wanted it. And the reason why they took the other guy was because he had so much more experience. He was a general foreman. And he wanted to go into labor relations.
So a labor rep was in labor relations?
Yes.
And so you got the next appointment?
The next, and ironically, someone moved on from labor to another, actually left the company. And so another opening came up, and I was given the job.
And how long, and now that's where you are currently?
Yep, I've been in labor relations for 16 years. When I first went into labor, I was the night shift labor rep in the body plant, which was an eye-opening experience.
What was eye-opening about it?
I didn't know anything about the contracts. Didn't know anything about a grievance. I didn't know anything about discipline. I didn't know anything about negotiations or anything. I had no idea what labor relations even did. So it was as overwhelming, if not more, than the first day I stepped into the plant. And it went on for a long time. Labor is really something that you have to experience before you ever get comfortable with it. And it took me probably a year and a half to 2 years to even feel like I even knew what I was doing.
You talked about being a part of negotiations. What was it like to be on the management side and the first time you had to negotiate a contract for your plan?
Well, my first experience with negotiations was all observation. I wasn't in the position to settle anything, add any input, because I didn't know anything. They were in negotiations actually when I arrived in the labor. They were, 1990 was a contract year. And all I did was watch. I didn't even know how to take good notes because I didn't know what part of the conversation was even relevant. Mm-hmm. And after about a year and a half of feeling totally inadequate, you know, every day just wrestling with not knowing what to do, you know, gradually you just kind of, you grab on to what's going on and what needs to be done and what's expected of you.
There were no labor classes that they sent you to?
Yeah, there was lots of classes.
But practical applications?
Practical application. When you know, you go to a class and they give you a manual and the answer would be in the manual. When you're out on the floor, someone asks you a question, they expect an answer during the conversation, not for you to have to go back to your office and look it up in the book.
Mm-hmm. You have to be able to, as they say, dance on your feet.
Right.
Doug Rademacher.
John, it's never been discussed in the interview, but you're a black man, and I'm curious.
I am.
Was your being diverse group of people and being selected, did that have anything to do with it? Were you one of many? Were you the only black man? Was there any women? And what was that like, breaking ground in that arena?
In labor? There were other African-American men in labor. In fact, the guy that left the company that I replaced was African-American. There were women. I can't remember Candace's last name, and then Mary Holmes. So we had women in the labor group at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
being a part of the labor part and being the ones that help make the decisions. And as you say, making the ultimate disciplines, actually, because when disciplines reached your office, that was usually a discharge type of discipline, or?
Not necessarily, but it was something that was serious, usually, and could have resulted in discharge. Sometimes mm-hmm. a discipline would reach our office, and the department may want a discharge, and we would not support discharge because the evidence or the proof of misconduct is our burden. Mm-hmm. And we had to make a call on whether or not we felt that we could substantiate the burden of proof.
What was one of the biggest things that surprised you about going into labor relations, outside of it being overwhelming on all the things you had to know?
I don't know that I'd characterize anything as a surprise. It was an eye-opener because you really had no knowledge when you were out there on the floor mm-hmm. of exactly what was going on, you know, between the union and management, and how big an impact that had on things that happened out on the floor.
And now, you initially started out as a labor rep right inside the Fisher Body plant, and it later went on to, you're the site-wide person, correct?
Yes.
And so you are now the head of labor relations. Is that correct?
Well, that's what some people say.
What they say.
Yeah.
Okay. Being the head of labor relations, well, let me digress a little bit before I get into that question. Because you're at Fisher Body, and Fisher Body went through a lot of name changes, what did you think about all those different name changes, and what did you call Fisher Body?
I call it the body plant. And, you know, I think that's probably the most common term that people refer to it as. There are some people that call it Fisher Body, there are some people that still call it BOC. To me, it's always been the body plant.
It's always been the body plant.
And I think that came about, I shouldn't say it's always been the body plant, because it was after I had moved from the body plant to the chassis operation. I actually moved to metal fab. Mm-hmm. And then it was the body plant, I think, more than anything else. It was when you're there, and that's the only plant that you've worked in, it was just the plant. Okay, it wasn't... No other nomenclature really was necessary. I mean, it was just the plant. It wasn't Fisher Body, it wasn't BLC, but it was once I moved away and had responsibilities in another plant. Then to reference back to the plant was no longer the plant. You had to call it by what it was.
You said that you worked at the fab plant also under
an office at the fab plant.
Was there anything that you noticed different because you were site wide? Was there anything that you noticed different between the Fisher Body plant and the other plants within the Lansing area?
No, because the same pride and heritage existed, because those other plants, the fab plant, the engine plant, the chassis plant, all of that stuff was Oldsmobile. And the same pride that I think that you found Fisher Body people, there were as many people who were, you know, loyal to the Oldsmobile name, plate, you know, and identity as there were Fisher Body.
So that Lansing site loyalty is what helped make it the capital of quality.
Yeah, absolutely. People were very proud to work for Oldsmobile. People were very proud to work for Fisher Body.
You've had quite a outstanding life working here in Lansing. You started out as a 17-year-old who went and took that extra time playing golf all day and said, well, I don't want to deal with Dad.
Don't let my dad know that he
doesn't get this.
So, and, you know, you took those last few minutes before time to close to go in and to now being the head of labor relations here at the site. What do you think about that? What does that make you think about?
Well, I consider myself extremely blessed. Okay, and there's not a day that goes by that I take you for granted.
Is there anything, given the fact that you are one of the ones in power, was there anything that you saw, experienced, that took place when you first came in under your time in line? Were some things that you said, well, I want to try to do something to change that, and now that you're at that table to make those negotiations, you've tried to make those changes happen?
You know, I can't point to one moment or one inspirational deed or episode. I think we've kind of all evolved together, you know, as to what's important and what needs to be changed and how we should be treating each other and how we should do business. I've seen some change just since we've closed the body plant and moved everybody out here to Delta Township. You're a product of your environment. Everybody is. And we do, you know, we went through the phase of, you know, screaming, yelling. I could scream with the best of them. I could pound the table with the best of them. And, you know, I knew every cuss word in the book, too, and knew the right moments to use them for emphasis. But even within the last 4 or 5 years, I've noticed a shift, not only in myself, you know, but the people that I deal with, the shop committee that we have here in Delta Township, the shop committee that's at 652. Our relationship just keeps evolving to where everyone is now more business-oriented than we're supposed to be.
So everyone was more business oriented.
Everybody was more business oriented to the extent that, you know, it used to be the union had their ideas about things and how they felt like they should go. Mm-hmm. And now it's, we all have a common understanding of how the business works. Okay? And it really makes things a lot easier, because I really feel like the union is more tuned in to the dollars and cents side of the business. It used to be, you know, 10, 12 years ago, the union wanted what they wanted, and they wanted it at all costs. Now they take a more balanced approach. Their membership is still their first priority. There's, you know, no mistake, no question about that. They're going to protect their membership. Job security is number one, and job satisfaction number two. And they hold that very near and dear. But it's easier now to have good, healthy dialogue on topics, you know, anything that we need to talk about the business, because they understand the business. They understand our competition. They understand what the needs of the business are, and they understand, you know, always driven by the needs of their people that they represent. And I think they do a very good job, because in order to really adequately represent people, I think you got to know what the business conditions are, mm-hmm. you know, if they're favorable or unfavorable. And I think the unions here in Lansing, 652 and 602, do a great job at that, especially in the last, like I said, 4 or 5 years.
John, because you grew up in this community, can you tell me, have you participated in community activities outside of the plant that General Motors had things to do in? Has this extended into the community for you?
Wow. Not necessarily from the GM standpoint, you know. I'd say that I'm probably just a typical person. You know, when my kids were little league and, you know, that age and whatnot, I coached and helped out and organized and did stuff like that. My church, you know, and, you know, get involved with things like that. But I don't think to the extent of some people in the community, like participate in non-commissions or committees and things like that. I haven't done anything.
And now, as far as benefits and things like that, you said that you're just now getting ready to finish your bachelor's. Is that something, the tuition assistance, that's something that managers get a part of? And do you find more? And because you're doing that now, do you find that and we're getting more people involved, that we have a more skilled workforce in terms of education?
Yes. I think it was rare to find people on the assembly line in 1977 that had a lot of college, let alone degrees. I think it's pretty commonplace now. You'd be hard-pressed to go to any one department in the plant now and find no one that has a degree. We've got people that are working in production that have advanced degrees, you know, and I just think that makes us better. It makes us more business savvy. It just, you know, for myself, I'm in the job that I want to be in. I don't know that it's healthy for me to stay in the job forever, but I will if they let me. Because I like what I'm doing, and I really feel like I make a difference. The pursuit of my bachelor's degree is just something that I committed to myself that I would do. It was one thing that was brought into question, actually, when I got this job, the fact that I didn't have it. But the folks who were making the decision were gracious enough to, you know, not hold that against me. And at the time, I had, in fact, just recently, like 2 months before, I interviewed for this current position, had re-enrolled, and was actually taking classes at the time. So, and, you know, I never really stopped going to school. I just kind of sporadically took a class here and there, but never really entered a degree program and, you know, tried to really knock it out, so...
We have transitioned now the body plant. You've worked in different facilities. Can you just briefly think of one of your best moments at Fisher Body?
Best moments at Fisher Body? I'm not struggling so much with finding a good moment. It's
which one?
Because there were a lot of good things that that happened in Fisher Body. I think probably the thing that I felt the best about was the last J.D. Power Award that we were given in the body plan, because it was clear when we got that award, everyone knew, not necessarily had come to grips with, but everyone knew that we were going to close that plant. And yet still, people were proud of what we did, and it was being recognized. And I just remember standing there that day and thinking about it, you know, that's a pretty amazing accomplishment, that here's a plant that we're not investing any money into. It's all band-aided together, and we're still able to do something like this. So I'd say that was probably a better moment. If I wouldn't say it was the absolute best, but I remember that moment, though.
Now, if you would describe, since you're part of the company, what is General Motors thinking in building a brand new facility as the Delta plant in Michigan? What would drive them to come up and pay those heating bills?
Well, it's you know, once you set the ball in motion and you've committed yourself to build plants. We could have built these plants anywhere in the world, let alone the United States. We could have built them anywhere in the world, but my personal thoughts are that it was important for the corporation to demonstrate to the UAW that General Motors had belief or faith in the UAW, that we could be as competitive right here, right in the heart of the UAW, right here in the state of Michigan. It's no accident that these two plants were built in this town. I think they wanted them built in Michigan, and Lansing was the best place. And there were several things that played into our favor. Number one was the age of the plants that we had, and the fact that we were able to do so much with so little in terms of technology and a state-of-the-art facility. But it was important, I think, to build these plants in Lansing or in Michigan, in the heartland of the UAW, you know, right on the home front, rather than try and hide these plants, you know, in a southern non-union state, or try and get away from, you know, anything, or do it as a joint venture, or, you know, put it in, another country. And that's why it's critically important that we are successful here, as well as at Lansing Grand River.
John, we've touched on a lot of things about your life. Is there anything that we haven't touched on that you'd like us to talk about?
Well, you asked me just a moment ago what was the best moment. I can tell you without any degree of difficulty what the worst moment was, and it's something that I strive and will continue to strive to avoid at all costs. In 1992, there was a strike that, in my opinion, and I think if you go back and ask anyone that was involved in that situation, was it necessary? And the answer is absolutely not. It was the most gut-wrenching, emotionally challenging thing that I've gone through in my work career. And the fact that the workforce was only out for like 2 days, it wasn't that. It was, you never get over watching people that you've known, in some cases for nearly all your life, walk out with picket signs. That's something that I don't ever want to happen again. And I'll do everything that I can do to keep that from ever happening again. It's not a pretty experience.
Well, John, as a vice president and leader of this local union, and I've worked at the plant for 27 and a half years now, and now out to the New Delta, I've grown up also with you and seen you grow, and it's been very rewarding, and it's a pleasure to work with you, and I've appreciated that.
I want to say thank you also, and I hope all the young people who are not sure what they want to do never know that decision you make at 17 can make a big difference on your life, and it can be a good thing.
Yes.
And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Marilyn.
Thank you for your interview.